Hi, and welcome back to Lecture Me Not, the podcast that brings you closer to the professor. I'm your host, Ethan. It's finally reading week. Pat yourself on the back. You've made it through assignments and midterms and stress and fully deserve the break. Take some time to really recharge and, you know, treat yourself, as we say. So for those of us in upper years, what are your plans like for the next couple of years? If you're like me and don't have a clear plan, that's okay. And it looks like I'm not alone here either, with lots of students going to talk to professors about future aspirations, whether they be grad school, professional schools, jobs in industry, etc. Today's guest, Dr. Dockstetter, noted that this was a topic that comes up often with her own students as well. Tune in to hear what she had to say about self-care, professor-student interactions, and her own tips for undergrads. So, today we have Dr. Dockstetter with us. She's a professor in the Human Biology Department, mainly teaching upper year courses. She's also done a postdoc from the lab that I work at. Welcome to the podcast. So, in terms of differences that you see with upper and, I guess, like first year, second year courses, what are some of the differences that you mainly see?
Between the lower courses, like first and second year, versus third and fourth? Mm-hmm. So I've never taught first or second year. There's no first to teach in our program. I haven't had the experience of teaching at the second year at this point. My understanding of, so when I talk to students in their third or fourth year and I say to them, remember when, or did you cover this? My understanding of what they get at the second year level is a fairly general overview of whatever that discipline is, because that's the second year for human biology program is the first year that they've actually determined what their program of choice and what they'll graduate with. So I'm in neuroscience, so most of the students that I work with are also either majors or neuroscience specialists.
Right.
And it's my understanding that in the second year, it's fairly general. It's a lot of information because everything's new to them. Mm-hmm. Every single part of it's new to them. And it's quite an overview. And I think the idea for that is to give them insight into what that topic is like, and also to venture into, just step in a bit into each of the subtopics or subcategories, so people can get an idea of what it is they like.
Right.
What's nice for me is by the time I get them, all of my courses I teach are fourth year except for one, which is a third year course. And so by the time I see these students, for the most part, they really enjoy the material. They've elected to choose that course. There are very few courses I teach that are mandatory courses, just my third year course. So they are truly interested in the topic, which is really nice. And they have figured that out by taking these more general courses and working their way towards something more specific. So when I see them, they're pretty keen.
Mm-hmm. So what's kind of the, what's the environment like for a fourth year course? Because it's sometimes hard to imagine from a first year perspective that, oh, like you're in a class of 1,500 people, like Psych 100, Bio 120, etc. But what's it like when you're in a 30, 40 100 person class?
So the majority of my classes are probably around maybe 50 students, between 30 and 50. I have two larger courses, but most of them I'd say at fourth year hit around the 50 student mark. It definitely is a more intimate feel. I do get to know the names of most of my students. Some of them are fairly quiet and I don't get to know their names as well, but I definitely get to know them all by sight. And there's more interaction. We can do different things. When you have smaller classes, it doesn't have to be midterm assignment exam, you know, and everything's multiple choice. And those things have to happen when you have very large classes, because it's impossible otherwise to be able to assess people in a realistic time frame. But when you only have 50 students, you can do different things in the classroom. So traditionally, for fourth year classes, we do have midterms and finals. Although for two of my courses, we don't have any exams at all. But more importantly, they get to do things that maybe they haven't experienced up until fourth year. Maybe they have before, but it would be more unusual. So we can do things like journal clubs. So we read an article before they come to class, and we sit around in groups and we talk about it, and then we talk about it as a class.
Right.
50 is kind of pushing it. Like, it's probably the limit for doing this, but I do it with my 50 student classes. My seminar course is a maximum of 30 students. It doesn't have exams or a midterm. We get maybe about 25% of people drop out of that because there's an assignment every single week. But those who stay really enjoy the course because all of it is learning that they do on their own before they come to class.
Oh, okay.
And then we just sit around and talk about it.
Right.
And in fact, I give them a general topic and then they get to pick the specific topic. They pick their own article. It can be in the human study or an animal study, doesn't matter. And then we just sit around and talk. And so by the time someone gets to fourth year, certainly they're going to get to know the people that they're in the classroom with because there's more interaction. They'll get to know their professor because I ask them their name and I get to know them because I hear them talk. It's probably more work intensive because the student will not have the luxury. I don't think it's a luxury, but the student may, of just waiting for the midterm, you know, showing up and then cramming a week, you know, a few days before the midterm and then showing up to class and then cramming for final.
Yeah.
So in fourth year, that's harder to do because there's usually several assessments rather than two or three assessments.
Yeah. I've noticed that too, because in my fourth year seminar course right now, I'm taking with Dr. Ju. It's an assignment every week or every 2 weeks. And it's, even though I'm not taking a full course load, it feels like I'm doing a lot more work.
Yeah.
Just in terms of keeping up with lectures or guest lectures, I guess I should say, and taking the time to actually make a response and thinking about what I learned rather than, oh, the midterm is like in a month. I can study for it in a week.
Yeah.
And just leaving all of what I learned until then. So I think it's a really good different approach to how people learn. And
yeah.
I think it took a little bit of getting used to, especially with the weekly responses and a little bit more hands-on work.
Yeah. There's many advantages, but there's really two things that importantly come out of doing regular work, being forced to do regular work. One is just from the neuroscience perspective is that's how you learn. That's how you learn best. How do you learn? Through repetition.
Mm-hmm.
Repetition, repetition, repetition. That's how you can learn anything. And it, you know, there's the neuroscience behind it that says how that's true. But everybody knows that in terms of, you know, if you decide to learn an instrument or play a sport or whatever, you just have to keep practicing. And so by kind of forcing your hand and making you do work on a regular basis, we actually see that the students acquire the information and keep it rather than this kind of binge on the material, regurgitate it in the midterm and then forget about it later on, which can happen when you're just setting it up with the midterm final. And the other thing is, by the time you're in fourth year, you're obviously 1 year away from not being an undergrad anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And real life and work is very, very rarely, although I'm sure there are jobs out there that are like this, you can, you know, hold off and then binge, hold off and then binge. But most of the real world is this constant, huge to-do list that you're just constantly trying to check off, right? And so I think by the time you're in fourth year, you are learning the material in a more realistic way that's going to emulate what your work ethic should really be like by the time you leave anyway.
Do you think it's ever possible to implement something similar in like second year where the courses aren't like massive, but they're a little bit more downsized where you don't have to have a weekly assessment per se, but something that forces students to kind of review weekly, kind of, I guess, like a quiz, but...
So obviously that would be up to each instructor. I totally think that's possible. But that's easy for me to say because I don't have any classes of 1,500 people. So in my very naive opinion, I think that it's doable, but I think a couple factors need to come into play. And one of them really is funding, actually, because in order to get into small groups and have more assignment-based, the course instructor would certainly need the TA support.
Right.
And to have the TA support at the level of small groups of students is a hard thing to do. Mm-hmm. So when you have 1,500 students, I know that I think there's 1,200 or so students in HMB 265, which is the genetics course. And they have many TAs on that, and they do tutorial sessions. And probably that's the best way right now that I'm aware of, that the larger classes can get at that, is outside of lecture time when they meet in the tutorial groups. Mm-hmm. And hopefully some of those tutorial groups, I'm assuming, and I'm sure it's true, are doing this learning that they have to do before they come into the classroom. So it can be done, but it's still done on perhaps a less personal level, at least when it comes to them interacting with the course instructor.
Oh, for sure.
I don't really know how you would get around that, especially at U of T.
Yeah, considering that we're such a big university, it makes it really hard to foster that professor-to-student relationship, especially in first year. And I feel like a lot of people get scared off
from that. Yeah.
And so when you come into fourth year, it's like a big, almost like a culture shock where, oh, like, I can actually talk to my professor and ask them questions.
Totally.
Rather than having that being deferred to a TA and then wait like 2 to 3 days and then they get back to you. Yep. And even then, you're not really sure if you're getting the right stuff or not.
Totally. I have many students every semester who say they haven't talked to a prof before. They've never come into office hours, or the professor's not known their name before. It's not really a reflection of me. It's really more of a reflection of the fact that now they're in fourth year and now we're looking at small numbers and they finally get recognized as an individual in the courses, which I think is helpful, but I'm sure all of them would have preferred if it had happened earlier, for sure.
Oh, for sure, yeah. So coming from, you said you have a neuroscience background, right? So mm-hmm. how did you come from your undergrad to where you are now? So kind of like a quick...
Okay, I'll give you the short version, the edited version of it. So I actually started university late. When I started U of T as an undergrad in my first year, I was 25.
Okay.
So I actually worked for a number of years. I had no idea what I wanted to do. When I started my undergrad, I only went part-time and I took a couple courses. Had really no idea, just kind of waiting to see what grabbed me. And it turns out that neuroscience grabbed me. I learned that when I took a psychology course, it was called abnormal psychology at the time. I don't even know if they'd call it that anymore, but it was called abnormal psychology. And I still remember chapter 8 was the pharmacology part where it talked about how drugs changed brains, you know, how they changed neurotransmission and reuptake mechanisms and all this stuff. And it just blew my mind. I thought it was the coolest thing ever. And so I just found myself starting to take more courses in that direction. I was lucky in the sense that I was going part-time because I really could slowly and methodically decide on which courses I was going to take rather than have to pick 5 at once. I was only ever having to take a couple at once. Mm-hmm. So, and then when I decided what I wanted to do, I thought I better just get on with it. And then I went full-time. I went through full-time through the summers too. And loved what I did, just kept doing more of it, finding research projects, got a summer tech position, and just more and more. And then I decided I wanted to go to graduate school. So I applied to, so I actually did my graduate work with Derek van der Kooi.
Right.
So I applied there as well as some other places, but Dr. van der Kooi was my first choice, and I was able to get into his lab. So I did graduate school with Derek van der Kooi. And it was obviously in the neuroscience side of things as well. I was more on the behavior, so we worked out with knockout mice and we did behavioral paradigms, that sort of thing. During my time in graduate school, I really loved what I was doing, but I always found that I was really interested in something we weren't doing at all, which was neuroimaging. So whenever we had a journal club and we're talking about neuroimaging papers and the way people's brains activated, somehow I really drew towards that.
Right.
So I thought about it when I was, you know, getting close to finishing grad school. And I know it was kind of late, but I did everything kind of late. So maybe that was okay. I know it was kind of late in the game, but I decided that I wanted to work with people rather than work with animals mm-hmm. once I was finished with my graduate school. So I was lucky enough that I found a supervisor at SickKids who is willing to take me on to do clinical research, even though all my background was animal work and basic science. And I sold myself to them, there were two supervisors, on the basis of that my animal work would inform my clinical work and I'd have a be able to bring a different perspective to it and a right. translational approach. Mm-hmm. So I guess I convinced them that that was a good idea. So then I switched to working with people. So I always worked in the field, always from that first course that I loved up until, you know, when I was at SickKids. I finished in 2015. I always worked basically in the field of aberrant behaviors. Okay. So addiction when I was working with Derek Vanderkooy. And then when I started working at SickKids, I worked more in the field, still within psychiatry, but more in the field of ADHD and OCD. And I learned how to do magnetoencephalography, which is a neuroimaging technique similar to EEG. Learned a little bit about MRI and DTI and worked in the Department of Psychiatry and then the Department of Psychology. Worked with children who had been treated with radiation for brain tumors, who had cognitive impairments. And all the while, my job or my interest lay in understanding how structural changes or underlying functional changes led to these behavioral outcomes you could see. And so even though my work with animals was far removed, it wasn't in the sense I was always looking at what is the structural change or the genetic change or something that underlies this aberrant right. behavior. And I just changed the technique and the model. So I was in neuroimaging at SickKids for my postdoc as well as a research associate position. Which on July 2015, I left to take a teaching position here at U of T. I had some teaching experience. I taught the gross anatomy and neuroanatomy labs at the chiropractic college, also for the naturopathic college, and also some of the labs at U of T
right.
for neuroanatomy. And but I didn't really actually have a ton of experience when it came to it. When I applied for this position, the teaching position, which was a neuroscience position, I again tried to sell myself on the basis of the breadth of my knowledge rather than how good a teacher I was, because right. my experience was 10 years earlier and I did just fine, but teaching labs is different from teaching, you know, seminar courses,
oh, for sure.
which I'd never taught and had no experience with. So I sold myself on the basis that I had this animal background, animal research background. I had a clinical human research background. And that between the two of them, you know, I had a wide range of interests and knowledge that would inform my teaching and contribute right. to being able to teach on a wide variety of topics, which I guess I also convinced them that that was a useful idea. So they hired me in 2015. On contract, I got a permanent position in 2017 after 2 years, and I have developed two of my own courses, which are both clinically based courses. We didn't have any clinically based courses before. Right. So I've done them for a couple of years now, and I started an experiential learning program at U of T this past summer, which we will continue on for hopefully for a long time to come, but we're definitely going to expand and do a larger program of that this coming summer, 2019. And that is to allow undergrads before they graduate more hands-on research experience, right. but in an experiential learning way. So not like a lab where you mm-hmm. come in and you follow a recipe and you do something, but more like a lab environment, like when you go to Dr. Vanderkooy's lab and you sit on journal clubs and meetings and you troubleshoot, your experiments aren't working, your staining's not working, and you do all that. So it's a 2-week intensive 9-to-5 boot camp
okay.
where the students come in every single day, they design their own experiment, they execute it, they troubleshoot it. We also have workshops on how to create a CV and the business side of science and things like that. And they leave with a CCR and a lot of confidence, actually, about understanding, actually, when you put science all together, rather than these little bits and pieces, how they all fit together in a bigger picture.
Yeah. I mean, Like, I feel like you don't really feel redundancy. I feel like you don't really get to know what you're doing with what you learned sometimes. Until you kind of get a job in a lab or in a position where you can apply the things that you learn. And a lot of my friends actually have expressed the same thing where they don't, it's like, we have a life science degree. What do we do with it after we graduate? And I think U of T, in a sense, doesn't do a great job of telling you what's available after you graduate. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, you know, professional schools are always an option, but nowadays with how competitive it is, it's really hard to just say, I can go to a professional school just like that, or mm-hmm. graduate school, or, you know, industry and stuff. That kind of stuff really gets left out in terms of mm-hmm. first, second, third year, and even in fourth year, where I think we had one speaker talk about what it's like to transition from clinical science or basic research science to an industry job. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really sad because you don't get a good sense, especially in like first and second year, where you're weighing your options and having to choose between, oh, do I want, you know, these kinds of courses for my degree or these other specific type of courses. And I feel like U of T could do a better job of explaining what's out there.
Yeah, I agree. I because all my students are in third or fourth year, a lot of them are sitting in this place of, oh my gosh, what am I going to do, you know, when I'm done? And so many of them, and maybe because it's life science, maybe because it's U of T, I don't know what it is, but so many of them, they want to go to grad school or med school. Mm-hmm. And that's all they see. Well, I have to go to grad school or med school. And it's really hard to get into grad school or med school. Statistically, just forgoing how strong their academic record is or what have you. But statistically, they're not going to get into either because the majority of people do not. And there's nothing that's supporting them to say, you don't have to, and these are your other options. And so the experiential program that we're doing, this lab boot camp, isn't really to say, hey, let's prep you for grad school. Although that will absolutely help to prep them for grad school because it gives them an idea of what it's like to live and breathe in this lab environment. But more than that, it gives them a sense if they really would like to apply their skills into a research environment. And so we had several students who left after that who came in not knowing what they wanted to do, which is the ideal candidate for the boot camp, actually. We didn't want people who knew exactly what they were going to do and had the grades to do it. We wanted people who would really benefit from the experience to help guide them. And so we had several students afterwards who left university and applied for research assistant positions. And I had three people out of the four people actually get those positions. And it wasn't because of the boot camp, because I don't think the boot camp really sold them on the CV, but it provided them confidence and this big picture thing. They could see forests, not just trees anymore. Right. And it helped them realize, oh, I do like science. And all this kind of came together for me, and this is something I'd like to pursue, or at least, you know, kick the tires, try it for a little while. Maybe they'd like it, maybe they wouldn't. But you're right, if they learn pieces and don't learn how to fit all the pieces together, it just feels like a bunch of pieces at the end.
And you come out of the degree wondering, like, what did I actually do in my 4 years? I know for sure I felt like that until I started working with Derek, where, I mean, I was coming out of second year, so I was a little bit more on the side of, oh, like, these are all the options available, and, you know, my grades aren't exactly stellar for med school. So getting to work with Derek and kind of seeing what it's like outside of school and mm-hmm. putting work into a lab where you can see results and mm-hmm. learn, see how science actually works mm-hmm. outside of, you know, oh, mm-hmm. you learn techniques maybe in a lab course, but even then, when you can't translate them into real life, it just feels like this, like, why did I do that even kind of feeling.
And I think the thing is that the things that you learn, they do make sense and they do fit into what you might do afterwards, but it's maybe one of the things that we need to do is help the students realize how to connect the dots.
Oh, yeah.
Because I don't think that the dots can't be connected. Sometimes, again, it's more of a trees versus forest thing. So, you know, your experience in Dirk van der Kooi's lab was probably really helpful at consolidating some of the things that you'd learned earlier mm-hmm. that you hadn't realized might all fit together at some point. You know, you're like, ah, that's why we learn this, or that's why we do this. Mm-hmm. But it's really, really hard to give you all the content knowledge that you need to have a life science degree and cultivate this big picture story, especially when you might take courses in different departments over the place. So I think that, again, we're a really big university, so it gets very, very difficult sometimes to be able to do these sorts of things. However, I think, going back to one of the reasons that you have the podcast to introduce students to professors, is I think all the pieces of the puzzle are there and the connections can be made. And what I really do suggest is that the students go to the profs and say, can I talk to you more about this subject? Mm-hmm. Or can you walk me through, you know, the practicalities of this or the importance of that or the relevance of so-and-so? I have students all the time who say, can they come talk to me because they don't know what they want to do next and they just want to, you know, hammer out some things with me.
For sure.
So I think U of T is a fabulous place. I think they're getting their education at one of the best places, period. I think we're try all the time to give them everything we can give them, but the personal piece is really hard. The bigger it gets, the harder that gets. And so by the time you hit third and fourth year, those professors do have the office hours and they do want to see you. Not that they don't in first or second year, but I'm familiar with third and fourth year. So I really do encourage actually that the student takes a bit of responsibility for trying to get to know their professor as well, mm-hmm. because they can have conversations that will help them, you know, what should my next steps be? This is what I like. This is what I don't like.
Right.
I have them all the time and I don't tell ever students what they should do at the end of it, but I think we can certainly start making lists of what, you know, what directions would work and what directions might not work and maybe help them think of things they haven't thought of before.
Right. I mean, because all of the profs have been through our steps of being an undergrad.
Totally.
And I feel one of the biggest reasons that we can't quite come to professors and ask, especially like in first or second year, is that we can't relate to people anymore, or we can't relate to professors anymore, in terms of, you know, they're lecturing, they have tenure or they might not have tenure, you know, they're teaching us this material and they seem like these people that are like super knowledgeable, when in the sense they've been through everything we've been through of what do? How do we get there, etc. And I feel, especially when you get to third and fourth year where you're more hands-on mm-hmm. with students, it's easier to get that connection versus mm-hmm. you know, con hall with 1500 kids.
Totally. And one of the things that your professors may or may not share with you is that they're totally fallible. And, you know, for me, I didn't start university until later in life, and I did it part-time. My full-time job was a bartender for the longest time, and I didn't stop doing that until I was probably, halfway through grad school. And, you know, I made some career changes a couple times. I made some research, redirected myself in my research a couple times. And I have a whole bunch of things that we're not going to get into right now, but it wasn't a straight line for me. It was mm-hmm. never a straight line for me. And that's true for a lot of people. I don't think I'm necessarily the exception to that. And I think it's important for students to realize that you can be whoever you want to be with some limitations, but you can do whatever you want to do if you really want to do it. And the fact that, you know, you flunked that first year doesn't necessarily have to mean your whole life has to change.
Oh, for sure.
And everything can't be what you want it to be. You may be made it harder for yourself, yeah, but to be honest, the very best lessons I learned in life were from my screw-ups.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm so happy. I totally love my job. You know, if I had done anything any differently, I probably wouldn't be doing this, and I love what I'm doing, so...
Right.
It's not a straight line.
Oh, for sure. Even for me, like, first year, I was like, oh, med school would be great.
Yeah. And,
you know, the midterms hit and the finals hit. And after first year, I kind of left wondering, like, do I still want to do school after 4 years of this?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's always a, it's always changing. Like, even now, like, I have different kind of, like, I guess not career goals, but outlooks of, like, oh, I can do this or I can do that. And it's all of my screw-ups and all of my failures that have told me that I can do other things. And I'm really glad I screwed up.
Yeah, yeah, I know what you mean. And the other thing that I think is really important is people need to have different experiences. And they don't necessarily have to screw them up, and they don't have to necessarily do them really amazingly either. But it's just as informative to find out it's not what you want to do, right? My work in Dr. Vandekoy's lab was amazing. I wouldn't change it for anything. But it did help me realize I actually want to work directly with people. I felt like basic science is so cool, but I wanted to work with the patients. I wanted to see the people that I was helping. And I realized that was really important for me. But I'm not sure, had I gone about it differently, that I would have realized that as strongly as I did. And also, I wouldn't have come to that human research side with the basic science knowledge that kind of makes it a nice, unique combination for me, and has really helped my teaching. So I think, and I took a whole bunch of courses that I didn't like when I started, and that helped push me into also what I did like. So I think creating experiences for yourself, regardless of what they are informative, whether you like them or you don't like them.
All right, so just to wrap things up, what are your three kind of top tips for undergrads, regardless of like what year?
Three top tips about what?
Anything. It can be, you know, how to survive university, how to cook, you know, should you cook?
Okay, all right. So very, very first one is self-care, actually. Since I've come to U of T for my 3 years of teaching, the amount of anxiety and stress that students have is extraordinary. It's really distressing for me to realize how many students are really struggling with things. And God, they're just taking on so much. So one of the things that you and I talked about before we started recording was taking 4 courses instead of 5 courses if you can, because it can be so overwhelming. And so self-care is my first one. Seems super hard to do, I think, for everybody at every age, including myself, but I've got better at it. I'd like everyone who's listening to start younger than I did, though. Self-care is really important. If you can't take care of yourself, it's so easy for the wheels to fall off. So any way you can manage that, whatever that is, self-care is the most important thing, actually, more than anything else. Second is, you don't have to go to grad school or med school. It actually, I promise you, you don't have to go to grad school or med school. People have it in their heads that it's something they must do. And if it's something they want to do, and they're totally into it with all of their heart and soul, then absolutely. But you don't have to. There's no prerequisite that when you've got life sciences at U of T and therefore you must do another degree afterwards. Don't have to do that. So give yourself a break on that and go and find out what your other options are. And the last thing is if you really want to learn something, you have to repeat it over and over and over and over again. And the idea of, you know, attending your lectures and then cramming for your exams and then attending your lectures and cramming for your exams might get you through, and maybe you'll get great marks. But I'm not confident from it. This is strictly neuroscience now. I'm not confident how much of that you're really going to retain. So when you graduate with a degree in specialist in neuroscience, you want to say at the end of it, I know all these things and I can bring them forward and do this and this and this. And the best way to do that is maybe take courses that force you to do ongoing work. Take those courses that are not just midterms, finals, but are more assignment driven. But if you don't, and it's a midterm exam kind of course, if you can, try and change the way that you do your work so that you are reading up the lectures on your way home after the lecture on the GO train or whatever, so that you're actually doing the readings before the class, those type of habits are more real life when you're done. You'll do better, in my opinion, but you'll certainly retain more information and feel more like, hey, I'm a qualified neuroscience specialist right. when I've left.
Well, like any degree, really.
Anything, like totally.
Any degree, just repetition, whether it's with like sports or learning, really, really, really does help. And it's changed how I learn too. Fourth year has been a lot of change, but it certainly helped a lot.
And I think it's also part of self-care, which you go back to, because it's never stress-free to cram for an exam and try and learn all the material in a day or two.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you for coming on to the podcast. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
It was great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Lecture Me Not. You can find the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, and other podcast hosting apps. Next week will be the last episode before the new year. We'll be talking with another professor in the human biology department, hopefully, who's a huge advocate for mental health. Until next time, lecture is over.